This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of Heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced this system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. It's fall today. It's feeling crisp, and it's beautiful, beautiful fall day. We're here at the home of Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, and I'm your host, as usual, Kathy Irway. So we're talking about Scandinavian food. This is a cuisine that has been in the spotlight ever since a little restaurant named Noma was named the best restaurant in the world. And I think it's safe to say that the culture of Scandinavian countries has been trickling into the mainstream more and more. There's concepts like the Danish word hygge, which roughly translates to coziness, and I hope I'm saying that right, hygge. And then there's the concept of fika, or tradition of fika, which is a Swedish daytime coffee break. But what about Norway? Its food, its culture, its people, its buzz phrases. And so I'm really glad that joining me to talk about all that and more is none other than one of the most prominent voices in Norwegian food today. She is the author of North Wild Kitchen, her blog, award-winning blog. It was named the best blog of the year by Editor's Choice by Severn Magazine in 2016. And she now has a book called North Wild Kitchen. So it is Norwegian food blogger, author, and all-around wonderful chef. It is Nevada Berg. Hi, Nevada.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining. What time is it there in Norway?
It's 7 o'clock right now.
Okay, so almost dinner time. So, thank
it actually passed. That's an interesting cultural thing. Is that in Norway we eat dinner much earlier, probably around 4:35
every day, or just Sundays or weekends?
No, every day, And I'm not sure if it's because work weeks are actually you get home earlier. Mm-hmm. Usually you start early and you finish 3:30.
Oh my gosh.
If you have kids, I've got a little one, then you end up eating dinner, around 4:35. So I was like, yes, actually, we finished already.
Wow. Okay.
I know.
Is it bedtime
different.
Yet?
No. I know. Soon.
Really?
Okay, well, it's actually really dark right now. Of course, it stays light until midnight or past midnight in the summer. But now it's getting darker and darker. So it's dark and it feels like it's bedtime, but it's not.
Okay.
No, don't worry. We don't go to bed too early.
Right. But it's a changing seasons right now, too, with the fall sort of in full swing now. And so Nevada, you moved to a beautiful, picturesque valley called Numedal in the heart of Norway. Tell me a little bit about what that's like, where it is geographically, what the climate is like, and give us a sense of where you are right now.
Yeah, so we are in this valley, Numedal, and it's actually known as the Medieval Valley, and that's because it has the most medieval structures still standing from the medieval ages in all of Norway. So it's kind of a little bit of a hidden gem in a sense, because it's also it's inland. I would say all the way south, but we're a little bit south, but in the center. So we would be between Oslo and Bergen.
Mm.
It actually used to be a big trading point. It was a big crossroads for the two major cities. But we are closer to Oslo. So we are just at the cusp of where Hardangervidda is. It's Europe's largest plateau. And then, so we kind of come down from this plateau where, say, the reindeer would be running. And then you come down a little bit. And then we are right here in this little mountainous valley. There's 1,400 people that live in, they would call it a village. It wouldn't even be a town. And it's, it is picturesque. It's great, actually great weather. We have all four seasons, so we can get a lot of snow in the winter, but we can have a really lovely summer.
Oh, it's not
as rainy as, say, Bergen would be. Bergen is known for the rain.
Okay.
So it's mild temperate, and it's, you know, just it's just stunning. For me, I love the mountains. I'm from originally from Salt Lake City in Utah. Mm-hmm. My family's from Colorado, so the mountains are kind of in our blood a bit.
Wow.
So I do feel quite at home here.
Have you read Growth of the Soil by Knut Hamsun? A classic sort of Norwegian novel about, I guess, making do on the land in Norway.
I haven't, actually.
Oh, okay. Never mind. It just reminds me.
I'm writing
me of
it down right now.
Okay.
I must read that.
Anyway, it just reminds me of maybe that's, you know, just moving to somewhere that is very opportune for farming. Because you and your husband bought a farm, right? A medieval, was it a medieval farm too? Or?
Well, we do. Well, we have buildings dates back to around the 16th, or the 1600s, I should say, the 17th century.
And our,
the farm itself is first noted in the 1600s, but of course, it's probably a bit older.
Perhaps.
But that's where the history kind of starts from the books.
So
we have, but our house itself is a little bit newer. It was built in the 50s, but the buildings we have around us, we have a blacksmith. We have two barns, and we have what's called the stabur, which is a food storage house.
Right.
So you'll see a lot of those around.
So that's like
but
a cold...
it's a small farm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about this cellar. So it's like an outdoors, outside of the main building of the house, that is, right? A separate sort of standing storage, like, closet, I guess.
Well, it's it would be a proper house, if you will. It sits up on four legs. It's above the ground. That was to prevent any mice from coming in because it's really big wooden log structures. Mm-hmm. It's a special form that they would use to build it. And so it has a bit of holes through it because it needed to air through. You would dry, you would hang your cured meats there, your fish, your flatbread, anything that you would need to store throughout the winter would be in there. So it's usually, it could be one story, but it's usually two story, could even be three stories.
Depending on how much you want to do.
It's a proper structure. Yeah, exactly. And how much you had and how big your farm was and wealth, of course, at the time.
And you've been using it, too, to salt and preserve some, what was it, the first thing? It sounds like you did a leg of lamb, a salt cured.
The curing.
Yeah.
Yeah, every year. In fact, we're gonna work a little bit on to fix it because the humidity level now, we think we'd like to get it right. So we are actually just started the curing process for our sheep leg, which is fenalor, and then the ribs of a lamb. And that's the pinnishet, and that's a traditional Christmas meal that they would eat. I would say about half of Norway would eat. And so we've actually got it. We do have a basement, so it's actually hanging when you walk in the door. We just have a bunch of, there's like two legs and four lamb ribs just hanging from the ceiling. And they're going to be there, you know, for the next 2 months. So.
Oh my goodness. I would be I would be very worried myself about, like, ruining some perfectly good lamb legs or ribs. Is this something that you ever did growing up in Salt Lake City, or did you have to, you know, learn when you came to Norway?
I definitely learned it from when we came. I've never done anything sort of like this before, but my husband's family is actually where they kind of introduced it to me. We've been married now for 13 years, and so I met his family. That was about 14 years ago.
And they're all Norwegian,
and I remember
they're
all Norwegian. They're from Bergen, so they live in Bergen. And we went there for the first time. It was for the first Christmas, and that's what they typically eat on the West Coast anyway, is this pinnishet, these cured lamb ribs. So his dad makes them by himself every year. So they were just hanging, and you could walk down the hallway, and you'd be like, what's that smell? You know, and you're like, oh, it's just lamb ribs that have been curing for, you know, for about 8 weeks now. And then, you know, so he kind of taught us how to do it. And I think it's really, it's not so hard. It kind of seems a bit like, oh, maybe that seems too difficult or I have to get it just right. And the truth is because it's a curing process, because you're using the salts and to kind of work into the meat. As long as you have the right temperature and you kind of keep an eye on it and the humidity is low, then, you know, you can just let it hang and you can forget about it for the most part and then go to it. So it's actually really simple. You just have to do it.
Okay.
Dive into it.
Wow. I love
you'll have to try it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're sharing all these, you know, family recipes, recipes passed down through generations that are, you know, you're sharing this through your blog and now your book in a way that it's accessible to anyone who wants to give this a try throughout your own sort of on the, you know, learning in the moment as you go along your journey. So it's really wonderful that you're sharing that. And you write in the beginning, you write, the more I study about Norway's food culture, the more I grasp its simultaneous simplicity and complexity. Tell me a little bit about what you mean about that and what are these dueling sort of values?
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of when you take a food culture for face value, you really can find something that's quite simple about it. You know, you can see that there are recipes that have been passed down, and yes, it's the things that maybe people associate with it already, such as lefse. And you see that the process of making certain things is quite simple and that it's just what it's always been. But then there is the complexity of dishes that, you know, maybe that are Norwegian, but yet at the same time, they're not Norwegian, and where they've come from and their roots and the evolution that the food culture has taken on. For example, the national dish in Norway is fårikål, which is basically lamb and cabbage. So it's a layer of lamb and cabbage into
fårikål. Fårikål. Okay. Got
fårikål.
It.
And which means lamb in cabbage, actually. Ooh. And so it's this layer of lamb cabbage and black pepper. And that's just stewed on the stove for a few hours. And it's delicious.
Mm.
And it's the national dish. But when you start to study the history and the roots of it, it's actually traced back to most likely back to Iceland.
Mm.
So it's an interesting complexity, I think, of food culture, and that certain cultures take on dishes that, you know, others, maybe that's where it started from, but it didn't take on as well. So then it gets moved over, it gets adapted, and then another culture really brings it to their heart and it becomes theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very fascinating. And I find that there is, you know, again, when I talk about lefse or these dishes that you think this is iconic Norwegian, but there's hundreds and hundreds of lefse recipes throughout the country. There's different textures, different thickness, different ingredients. And it's amazing how it does vary within a country that only has 5 million people, but they're all spread out. And you think from next door, neighbor to neighbor, it wouldn't be so different, but it is. And so I think there's this history, there's this culture, there's, you know, wars, there's religion, there's all these elements that have played a role in shaping the food culture to make it what it is today. And of course, it continues to change because of everything else that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's simple, and yet at the same time, as I was trying to explain, a complexity as well. But that's what's fascinating about any food culture.
And not to mention mountains in between these small villages and who knows, rivers, fjords, and so forth that are keeping everyone in their own sort of traditions a little bit. I think that's really wonderful that you're sharing that. Do you think that most Norwegians know that, you know, a certain dish came from Iceland or, I don't know, all these like sort of backstories and histories of these iconic dishes?
You know, I would probably say it's just like anywhere where, you know, you get so used to growing up in something that you don't necessarily look behind it. You don't need to understand why. You just kind of go with it because it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's easy for me coming from an outsider's point of view because, number one, I'm fascinated by history and culture and I'm looking for it. So it's easy for me to find these answers. Whereas I don't think normally you would spend as much time trying to understand the history behind the dish, even though it's very interesting. But I know that if I was to look at where I come from, I probably wouldn't have spent time or have the knowledge for it. But I think that's just that's anywhere you go.
Something about being immersed.
And I do feel that when I do, I always try every recipe that I put out, I try to involve the history behind it or the story that goes with it, because there's so much more to just the plate itself. And I do get the feedback that people are they love reading about it. They love understanding more about what it is. And so that's nice. That's nice to hear that people enjoy that part of it.
And I love cookbooks that do that. So I really, really appreciate your cookbook. And I love that you don't shy away from these really traditional recipes, too, even though, you know, as you admit, we live in a global food supply these days where we have an abundance of ingredients at our disposal, not to mention refrigeration. Yet you still have recipes for how to preserve lamb, you know, cured lamb leg, for instance, hot smoked mackerel. And for many of Norwegians perhaps reading this is like nostalgic, but for myself in a concrete jungle, I find this excitingly new. For instance, you know, taking what did you write? You had a fish cooked on a stone over a hot fire in the middle of the forest. That flavor is something that sounds pretty new to me. But what can we learn about, you know, sharing these older traditions and keeping them going?
Yeah, I think it's so important. It's so valuable. And you learn something new, because when we have that knowledge, I think we can create even more. We can be inspired to do more as well. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we have these, because, you know, this is where the food really comes from. If you understand preservation, curing, and, you know, you can do so much more. You have so much more just knowledge in your culinary, you know, background than if you don't know it. And I think, it belongs to the food culture. This has shaped the food culture. It's such an ingrained part of it that you can't overlook it. And at the same time, what I try to do is I balance it out with the traditions and then using just Norwegian ingredients in maybe a little bit more creative ways or fun ways. That's my challenge to myself, is to, you know, try to think about what grows here, what's natural here, and then create from that. So you get a bit of both, because I think they're both really important. They both shape how we look at the food. The food is changing, but at the same time, it still stays the same. And there's something about when something just carries on and it keeps to the culture. And there's so much change in the world. There's so many new things coming in. We have access to everything now, that it's nice to still have those things that, you know, were a part of the culture, and then they remain and they're being passed down, because it is something about having something that is yours, that is you, belongs to this place, that you can keep sharing with the younger generation. And of course, those skills come in handy, being able to cook over a fire, know how to even cook a fire, so that you're not stranded and you can't sit there and think, ooh, you know, what do I do now? Because I'm only used to shopping at the grocery store. I just think and as great as that is, I mean, it's nice to have these skills that you might come in handy one day.
Yeah.
And if they don't come in handy, they're really fun. That's how, you know, that's how we all started eating out in the first place, was over fire. And there's a community aspect to it as well. And the sharing between each other that happens when you make food by hand, instead of relying on flavors and things from everywhere else. It's what can you make? And it's a lot of love that goes into that, a lot of love that's been made to help preserve these things.
Absolutely. And it sounds really, really tasty too. So I want to talk more about some of your really, really creative and interesting and traditional recipes just after a quick little commercial break, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Nevada Berg, expert, author, blogger of North Wild Kitchen, and we're talking about Norwegian food. So, Nevada, you were saying that one, the national dish is this lamb and cabbage stew called Fårikål. But what are some other sort of hallmarks of Norwegian cuisine? What are some of the sort of, I guess, you know, signature Norwegian foods that we should know about?
Kathy?
Yes. Hi. Are you there?
Sorry, I've got music playing in my ear. Oh, there we go.
Okay, sorry about that.
Sorry. I didn't hear a thing you said, so you'll have to say it over.
No problem. We were jamming some tunes to you just for fun, extra.
Out.
Yeah. We thought you could use it. I'm just kidding. So
Easy
I was
way.
Just saying, yeah. So what are some like hallmarks of Norwegian cuisine, other than Fårikål, that we should know about to kind of get grounded in Norwegian cuisine? Any other sort of famous or ingredients, things like that?
Yeah, there's, you know, Norway is obviously known for the coast and the coastline.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fish. It's amazing seafood. Some of the best quality
herring,
you can get. Herring, yeah. And it's, you know, fish soup.
Fiskasoup.
I'd say fish cakes.
Fiskakaken.
Fiskasupa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, fiskakaka. And, you know, we have, one of my favorites on the coast is bacalao, which is actually the Portuguese and Spanish word for the dry fish, dry and salted fish. But it's become, in Kristiansand, it's like the dish. And it's just what they adopted in during the trade when the Spanish came over. And so I know, which is really interesting because it's, you know, tomatoes and oil, olive oil, and it's, you know, red peppers. And it's just, it's a delicious dish, but it's very much become, you know, a Norwegian dish.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, we're in the fall, and, well, we're at the end of fall now, but we have, of course, apple cake, and which is one of my favorites. And now we're in hunting season. So in our area, we have, it's quite a big area for hunting. So there's moose, there's reindeer, there's grouse.
Grouse, yep.
Grouse, which is the bird, that's the English.
Sort
sometimes
of like
I'm like,
quail.
Wait, that was the English? Or the English? you know, and I'm just trying to think. We have many. Lefse, the baked
Lefse.
Goods,
okay.
You know,
mm-hmm.
You got to go with the bolla, which is the kind of cinnamon buns. And that's the interesting thing about Norwegian baked goods is that most of them contain cardamom, which is a spice you wouldn't really associate necessarily with Norway, but it's in everything. And so to us, that's the spice of Norway, cardamom. And so we have cinnamon rolls and just lots of waffles, of course, and pancakes, which are more similar. The Norwegian pancake is more similar to a crepe.
Okay.
And I don't actually have that one in the cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the next one. But
there's so sweet buns with cardamom.
Panikake.
Mm-hmm. See,
go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to mention, actually, the wild nettle and honey cake in your book. It looks like nettles, it's fascinating. It sounds like you found research that nettles have been discovered in Norwegian burial, you know, Norwegian Viking burial ships from around 800 AD or so. So they were eating nettles since
they were eating it and they're using it for their clothing because the fibers of nettle is really strong.
Okay.
So instead of having cotton, you would use nettle as well to create clothing. And nettle is amazing because it actually is one of those things where, yes, you can eat it, you can make clothing out of it, it can be a fertilizer for your garden. So it's actually it's medicinal, and it's one of those things that, you know, it's horrible when you get a bunch brushed against your skin because it gives you all itchy and poppy.
Yeah, I was just thinking about wearing a nettle shirt, and I'm like, that must be all itchy.
Right? Yeah, it might be. Maybe the way they process it.
Yeah, you
take out all the sting.
Mm-hmm.
but it was, and you know, what's quite typical of the Norwegian dishes, you will find a nettle soup.
Yes.
And that's the most common, or say nettle tea. So nettle tea, nettle soup. But I wanted to come up with something, a different way of using nettle.
So that's your own creation.
And we have a lot of honey.
Huh. Awesome.
Yeah, so this is my own creation. And this was, you know, we have a lot of bees and local honey around. And so it just kind of, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we did something sweet with nettle instead of it always being savory?
I love that you so mashed it up. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. And so, yeah, honey and nettle is delicious. And that's why I also have the mini nettle pavlovas. Because I, again, wanted to kind of play off of a bit of that sweet, like something you wouldn't expect nettle to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so diverse. It's such a diverse superfood. So those are kind of the fun innovations.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, it makes a cake a little bit more nutritious, too. Just kind of hide the greens in there, right in the cake batter.
Yeah, exactly.
It looks great. Also, you have Norwegian meatballs in here with a creamed cabbage side dish, which also looks delicious. Are the meatballs similar to the Swedish meatballs we've all had at IKEA? And
right.
Are they the same? What's the story?
They're a bit, you know, they're a little bit different. And the Norwegian will tell you, and the Swedish person will, they'll say, yes, there's the difference. And I would say that the Norwegian meatball is larger. The Swedish ones are quite small. They're quite condensed. They're in that, you know, that brown gravy.
Yes.
And the Norwegian ones tend to be much bigger. And they are as well cooked into a brown sauce. But
okay.
And they're both served with the lingonberry. I think it's still kind of a traditional. I'm not sure if the Swedish do creamed cabbage. It's either served with creamed cabbage or with
that.
The creamed pea. So I'm not sure if they do that. But it is different. It's a little different. It'd be interesting to do kind of a bit of a taste off.
I want to try
really compare
that.
The two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely want to try the creamed cabbage, too. That sounds like a fun new way of doing it, for me at least. So you also you also have this, like, twisted, okay, this is, I need to do this on my next camping or anytime there's a bonfire. You took some bread dough, some yeast-risen bread dough, and twisted it around a stick and then put it directly on the fire to make a twisted bread with carrots and oats. Over a fire. So this is a common thing? Pina brod?
It is. It's very normal. It's very typical. The carrot and the oats is kind of my throwing in there.
Okay.
Something a bit different. But no, it's very normal. You can also cover it with, like they'll do cover it with cinnamon and sugar. So it becomes more of a sweet bread as a dessert. But it's a really great thing because it can be quite versatile. Once you just have the basic dough, you can add in different flavors. You can make it savory or sweet. You can dip it into things.
Thought is, can I make like a stromboli in there? And, you know, with like pepperoni and cheese and...
Definitely.
Okay.
And I think you should... And that's kind of like my hope with the cookbook is because there are ingredients in here that might not be available in everyone's area.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that yes, there I do provide substitutes. But at the same time, I want to inspire people because that's how we should cook. We should look at something and think, oh, okay, maybe I could fill it with that. That would be really great. Or oh, I don't have that ingredient, but I do have this that's growing local. So I would hope people would look around what they have and kind of their own taste and just be inspired and think, oh, I'm going to make it, but I can make it my own way too.
Mm-hmm. Can we, for instance, what would you suggest we substitute for reindeer?
For reindeer, you know, if you can get any other
venison
type of, like, another type of, it could be, I'm trying to think now, moose or elk. But if not, if you can't get any kind of wild meat, you know, you can definitely go with beef, by all means. It's not going to have that same kind of heartiness to it, but, you know, I still think the flavors will come out, so I think if you can't do it, try it with beef until you're able to get it with something,
Yeah, I'm going to definitely, I mean, all these dishes, like the hearty stews and, you know, stuffed cabbage here you have, it just looks so tempting. And I'm sure, you know, it's about the little things like the berries that are there and, you know, featured here and there, the herbs that are used, like as you mentioned. So I'm sure it'll be a kind of new taste sense anyway. And we're running out of time, but I want to talk about this Romgrød ice cream. That you have. It looks so beautiful.
Yeah, this is quite a fun dish actually. It's my take on, and the name of it is rømmegrøt, which is okay. A sour cream
obviously
porridge.
Obviously, I can't speak Norwegian.
Don't worry. Yeah, I still can't get Norwegian words right. So it's, no, don't worry. Anyway, so rømmegrøt is it's porridge. It's made of sour cream and basically flour, and you kind of stir it up and you add a bit of milk in there and you just stir until it becomes this really beautiful porridge, and the fat content is really high in the sour cream here, so butter rises to the top, and then you pour that on the top when you serve it with cinnamon and sugar.
Okay.
And of course I have that recipe in here as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's traditionally linked with the summer high holidays, which would be midsummer, and then there's like two other religious high holidays in July. And it was really hot, and there was one time when I thought, I just don't want to make rømmegrøt, to be honest.
Okay.
And I thought, well, what can I do? You know, how can I play on that? And it was hot, and I thought, well, let's do ice cream because, you know, it's a great time of year, and everyone's eating ice cream. And my first memory of ice cream in Norway was when I was in Bergen with my husband's family, and we're waiting in line, and they take this kind of soft serve ice cream in the cone, and what they do is they dip it into like a chocolate powder, which is kind of like chocolate milk, like the powder, and they just covered it. And I never seen that before, and I thought that's really fascinating. So I kind of connected that memory and thought how fun it would be to then take a sour cream based ice cream, which is the rømmegrøt, put it in the cone, and then sprinkle the cinnamon and the sugar all over the top of it. And also what you tend to serve it with when you're at the summer farm, that's kind of during the summer, of course, when the dish is mainly in its high season, you'll serve it with this dried sheep leg, the one that we talked about earlier.
Mm.
And it's kind of cut and it's cured, so it's a cured sheep leg. And they would serve it alongside it. So I thought, oh, well, to kind of play on that as well, you could cut a few pieces up, fry them so they're kind of crispy, and top it on the ice cream as well. So then you get
salty,
the complete
sweet,
rømmegrøt meal in one.
That's
and
so cool.
So it's just, so it's my play on if it's summer and it's hot and you're like, oh, I really don't feel like a hot bowl of sour cream porridge, maybe I can do that.
Yes, instead of a hot porridge, sweet porridge, it's a cold, creamy dessert. I love it.
Yes, yes.
That is
and it's
just,
very good.
That's a really great example of, taking these older traditions and making them something that you like in a little bit of a new way. And I love that you've done this so lovingly throughout this book. So I guess that's about all the time we have for today, but I can't wait to tell more people about this book, share it around. It is just out from Prestel, North Wild Kitchen. And Nevada, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Awesome. So thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.